You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we felt like this week, more so than maybe any other week, it'd be important to do a stick to sports cast.
There are lots of different reactions to what's happened this week, positive or negative. And I'm not here to tell you what the right way to react to an event like what's happened this week is. That's a very personal thing, as long as you're not hurting anyone else. One way to do it, as you have embraced, is to just go hardcore into sports.
Yeah, go hardcore into sports and drinking.
Well, yeah, we're continuing that.
Don't forget about drinking, because it's a stick to sports cast and also drinking.
But we will not be, sadly, reviewing the season finale of Atlanta in the first week of that.
Not just the season finale, the entire series.
Critically acclaimed show, sadly. We don't even have time for it, because there is a lot of sports going on in the city of Seattle. Yes. I don't know if you've noticed that.
And we have to stick to them.
We do.
Have to stick to them.
This upcoming week, I think there is a case to be made. I didn't do any research on this part of it, that it is the biggest sports weekend, football weekend, in Seattle sports history.
Really?
I mean, you've got the Huskies hosting game day,
yeah,
playing on national TV against ranked USC in a must-win game for the college football playoff. And then you have the Seahawks playing on Sunday Night Football against the New England Patriots, their somewhat hated rivals.
Yeah, in a rematch of a game that happened?
I've never heard of it.
In a rematch of a game that was canceled.
Yeah. Weird decision by the NFL that year, but you know, not much weirder than many other NFL decisions. They canceled it because of Deflategate. And then coming off of playing Monday Night Football. So it's like it's a big stretch here.
All right, it's a big stretch.
Yeah.
But do you want to know why else it's a big stretch?
Why else is it a big stretch?
Because it's after October 31st, 2016. And we are going to be drinking a Stone Enjoy after October 31st, 2016, Brett IPA.
So this is a series that the Stone Brewing Company in San Diego does, where they have both the Enjoy After and Enjoy Before,
yes,
various dates, which is just a way to make pretentious beer drinkers feel excited about their beer.
Or to show excitement and or patience.
That's true.
So we've only had the Enjoy By beers, right?
That is true.
And you got this beer like a year ago and told me about it. And I said, that'll be a fun thing to talk about on the podcast that we eventually have in a year.
Yeah, see, we're very prescient. If only everyone had seen the future so well.
When we have... That was one of my bold predictions of last year. Bold predictions of 2016 would be rekindling the Fabulous Pelton Cast. Do you want to read to us about the Stone Enjoy after October 31st, 2016, while I try to open it like a champagne bottle?
Yes. This IPA is spiked at bottling with Brettanomyces. I'd have no idea how to pronounce that. A wild yeast that, over time, brings about charmingly unpredictable complexities of spike. Why are you pointing that at me?
I'm good at opening up champagne bottles.
Why are you pointing it at me?
It's not going to hit you. Don't worry.
It's irrelevant how good you are at opening them. With charmingly unpredictable complexities of spice, acidity, and more. Oh, God. It's overflowing. The excitement of a live podcast, which is not actually live.
The cork has struck you.
I'm down. The operative words in our beer cellaring thesis are over time. For those of you who are impatient or like to experiment, the earliest we recommend sampling this beer is 1 year before the date on the label.
Do they recommend sampling it from the table? Because it's spilling everywhere right now.
They do not recommend okay. that. Ideally, you'll want to cellar the beer up to or beyond the enjoy after date to help it reach its full evolutionary potential.
And apparently maybe sideways.
At that point, yeah. Some facets of the Brett characteristics will have mellowed, while others will have become more profound. It all matures into a fascinating and delicious culmination. Individual results will vary, and that's both the beauty and the intent behind this beer.
I was looking at Beer Advocate, the Beer Advocate ratings, and it only has an 87% on Beer Advocate.
Well, do you think these people, have they drank it in the last
week?
That
was the thing that I was going to say, is there are so many reviews that are before October 31st. It's like the review should only be, I am impatient and could not wait until October 31st. That's the review. It's a review of yourself, not a review of the beer.
zero-star review.
But then I found out that there's an Enjoy by July 4th, 2016.
Yeah. I mean, there are a variety.
Or Enjoy after July 4th. It's the Brett, so it's the same beer that they're talking about.
Yes, but each of them, as they say, has its own flavor characteristics.
Yeah, so it would be impossible. I mean, we're not going to taste this because it's just pouring everywhere.
I mean, at some point you could just start pouring it.
All right.
I don't know what I'm going to fill with while you're doing this, but I will continue talking. It's like you know, like tweeting your way through it. This is me talking my way
through. Stick to sports.
I don't know if there are any sports that you wouldn't want to weigh in on here.
Oh my God, this beer is going everywhere.
Yeah, it really is.
This is our worst experiment with drinking beer.
We can't do anything right now.
I think on last week's podcast we spilled beer everywhere also.
You did. Yes. The listener did not know that though, because I edited that portion out.
Did you really?
I think so.
Wow.
It was very professional.
Wow. That sounds very
professional.
Much more
professional than this attempt to drink beer.
Drink beer. I have a backup beer in the fridge, which we may be drinking.
I think eventually it'll be drinkable. Do you want to get to the sports then?
Well, no, I don't want to get to the sports just yet.
Okay.
Because I was going to... Did I talk to you about this already?
No.
You don't even know what I'm talking about. How could you know whether I've talked to you about it?
Well, okay, I assume what you're talking to me about is what's on your laptop right now. That's the only context I have for this. The listener has no context.
Not even close. Just politics. Did I tell you where we went before the Seahawks game on Monday?
You did not.
I didn't?
No.
I literally do not remember what I told you on Monday. I saw you on Monday and have no recollection of what we talked about. Probably the football game, but...
Yeah, we mostly stuck to sports.
Before the game, I went to, finally, to Flatstick Pub in Pioneer Square.
Oh, nice. That explains a lot, first off.
Yeah. Do you want to know what else explains a lot?
What?
Do you want to know how much the beer was?
Sure.
Almost every beer, right? So Flatstick Pub is a bar that has mini golf throughout the pub. The original location is in Kirkland, and we spent the last 2 years tailgating with the dudes who own Flatstick Pub in Kirkland as they were building out the location in Pioneer Square.
That's true.
So for the first time, Chris and I... disloyal listener Chris and I decided to go to Flatstick Pub before the game, right?
Yeah.
It's all Washington State beers.
Yes.
And every single one of those beers was $3.50 for a pint.
That's pretty good.
That is really good.
Pretty good.
I mean, we're talking good beer here, right? It was very good beer, and it was all $3.50. So naturally, consumed quite a bit of it.
Yes. And then you don't remember what you told me after the game, hours later.
It was just such a great experience having that. It was easy to get in. It was full, but it was easy to get beer. That's the thing. It wasn't hard to get the $3.50 beer. Because normally, I mean, when I was walking over, I saw people standing on outside patio drinking Coors Light out of a can. And I bet they paid $6 at least for that Coors Light out of the can. And it might not have been that easy to get.
Yeah.
And so it was easy to get to the beer. You're in kind of a dungeon, like a...
it's underground, right?
It's the spot of the old Comedy Underground, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah. I would give it 2 hearty thumbs up.
Two frosty mugs up?
Is that two frosty?
I don't know.
Or is that a rating system that we have?
It seems like a
frosty mug.
It seems like a good beer rating system. The beer I had last week.
I need to tell you more about the Flatstick Pub.
Okay.
The thing that really pulled it together, though, right? Drinking 350 IPAs, feeling good, right? The thing that really pulled it together was the street tacos that they had available.
Uh-huh.
Provided by Manu of Manu's Bodega, right?
Where is Manu's Bodega located?
Also in Pioneer Square.
Huh.
Apparently they have a guava-filled cookie.
I'm interested in that.
Yeah.
I'd eat that.
Yeah, I was trying to find a picture of the Manu's guava-filled cookie. But if we're looking for something that could be a competitor for greatest cookie in Seattle... I feel like a guava-filled cookie could be a competitor.
It's a wild card. It's in the mix.
But the Manu Street tacos that they had, they just offered tacos, right? Tacos and salsa. And Manu is there himself making them. I learned because I just saw a photo of him. I was like, oh, that was Manu. The pork taco that Manu made, it's a traditional street taco, right?
Yeah.
Nothing too fancy. But the pork in the taco was the juiciest pork that I have ever had in my entire life.
You had me at street taco.
They were some of the best tacos that I've ever had. It was amazing. And that coupled with the 350 beer, I mean, we naturally didn't play mini golf or anything like that.
No.
But it was a great experience.
I mean, I think that's less for less probably a tailgatey experience, like a pre-funking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little crowded to play, presumably.
Yeah. And we hung out with our good friends, the owners of Flatstick Pub.
Nice.
Yeah.
Have you given this a try?
I haven't.
I find it a little dry for my taste, I would say, would be my takeaway. Mm,
a little too Brett for me. This is not a beer for you.
It's an interesting flavor.
Wasn't the other thing that I said was not a beer for? Did I say that about something else?
No, you said that Stranger Things was not for me.
Stranger Things is not a show
for me. It was not for me. You were right. 100% right.
It's really honey flavored. You get a lot of honey.
Yeah.
It's all not, right. I wouldn't say it was too dry for me.
Can I propose a toast right now?
All right.
To the Seattle Sounders for advancing in the MLS Cup playoffs to the Western Conference Finals with a loss.
What a loss it was. Very nice loss.
Really one of the most impressive losses in franchise history. So as we talked about on last week's podcast, the Sounders took a 3-0 lead in the home leg of their two-game aggregate series with FC Dallas, which meant that all they had to do was lose by less than 3 goals, and potentially less than 4 goals if they scored, which, lo and behold, after conceding the first goal, they did, and that the game was basically over then.
Did you get a little bit nervous when Dallas scored their first goal?
Oh, of course.
I was a little bit nervous.
Yeah. I mean, the defense was generally pretty stout, but Dallas also was having kind of the run of play at that point.
I thought it was a little bit impressive that the Sounders kept attacking because they had other chances to score aside from the goal that they did score.
Yeah.
The goal that they did score is a little bit fluky with Mears kind of randomly winning the ball back and then crossing into the box. But they had other chances, and I give it to the Sounders for not just sitting back, right? They're playing soccer for a lot of that match.
Yeah. It was a fun match to watch. Enjoyable. Not necessarily dramatic in the later stages.
No, I mean, when they scored the goal, it was over. We could have changed the channel completely.
And then I fortunately was watching this on a setup where I had that game on streaming and then the Sunday Night Football on at the same time. So didn't need to go back and forth.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's something.
But the big story that came out of this game, unfortunately, is that Jordan Morris left at halftime with what was later diagnosed as a strained hamstring.
Yeah, how serious is this?
It's tough to say. They're calling him day-to-day, which then again, is the joke goes, then again, aren't we all? But the Sounders do not play again because an interesting feature of the MLS Cup playoffs to those of, for those of you who are new
is that it keeps going, is that it's the same as the MLS regular season and never ends.
It's true. But they have a break in the midst of the playoffs because there's one of these international breaks where international teams play and call up some of the players. So the USA is hosting Mexico on Friday in Columbus, site of past Dos Acero glory.
Oh, wow.
Is part of
you don't
the,
mess with Team USA in Columbus.
You don't. The hexagonal World Cup qualifying for CONCACAF. Jordan Morris was originally on that squad. He has now been removed from the team after going to Columbus to get checked out provisionally by the U.S. national team. Medical staff returned to Seattle, and he will now have a couple weeks to rest because the Sounders don't play again until Tuesday, November 22nd, when they host Colorado in the first game of their two-game aggregate series.
So in this scenario, it is good for the Sounders.
It is great for the Sounders. And they've also got other players. Andreas Evenschitz working his way back from injury.
This is a 17-day break, is that right? 16-day break?
16-day, yeah.
Got so normally a 16-day break in the middle of the playoffs. Not advised. For the Sounders, very fortunate.
Yeah, they've got Roman Torres and Brad Evans who, you know, have been limited because of more nagging injuries in their case. They both should be good to go, I think, by that point, along with Evenschitz. And then we'll see on Morris. Obviously, the Sounders, you know, need him to be successful.
Yeah, fingers crossed for Jordan Morris.
But since we've got that break, we'll preview Colorado next week.
In 6 to 8 weeks.
Yes. In the spring when the MLS resumes its ongoing 2016
And then
season.
Another interesting feature is after that series of matches, there's another 6 weeks off.
I still don't quite understand how they get to December 10th. I haven't quite teased that out. I think there is another week-long break in there.
Well, they would take a week, and then the follow-up would be a week later, like November 30th.
The return match is on November 27th, but then they take the weekend of the 3rd and 4th off entirely.
Well, you got to take the 3rd and 4th off.
MLS Cup on Saturday, December 10th, which is the first day after the end of the college football season. So that's why they prefer that.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
So.
Great. And then another toast is in order.
Wait, is it?
If we're toasting things. Yeah, it is. You don't think it is?
For what?
For Husky basketball.
For beating Western in an exhibition? Oh, for the recruiting class.
For bringing the number three, potentially number two recruiting class, depending on who you're looking at, in the country, and probably Lorenzo Romar's best recruiting class ever.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. So he's had signed five players today in the beginning of the early signing period. That class, Nathan Hale forward, Michael Porter Jr., who is the number two ranked player nationally by ESPN's Recruiting Nation.
And whose father is on the Husky coaching staff.
He is. Then his brother is also committed in a future year. So they will, of course, be playing this year for Brandon Roy and Nathan Hale, which will mean I will attend Nathan Hale basketball for the first time in my life.
Okay.
Very excited about that.
I'm gonna go to one of those games. How crazy are they?
So they're playing Garfield at one point this season. I believe in late January is when it's scheduled for. And Garfield supplying two members of the 2017 Husky recruiting class. Guards Dejon Davis, who's ranked number 43 nationally by ESPN and had decommitted over the summer, explored his options, and then recommitted on Monday, I believe. Yeah. And then Jalen Noel, who is the number 56 ranked player nationally. And then a couple of non-local players, at least now, point guard Blake Harris from North Carolina, who's a four-star recruit, and Malian power forward, who's playing by way of St. Louis, Mamoudou Diarra, who's a three-star recruit.
So a couple things about this recruiting class, right? Without getting too deep into it, it was really interesting to hear Lorenzo Romar talking today about it. But Michael Porter, who I think it's so hard to tell because Markel Fultz is maybe the number one player in the country, and then you're bringing in Michael Porter, who maybe is the number two player in the country. It's hard to tell who's the highest recruited player that he's ever gotten.
Yes.
But hearing Lorenzo Romar talk about Michael Porter and saying that he's the best shooter that he's ever recruited, and this is the person who's recruited Brandon Roy.
I mean, I wouldn't put Brandon Roy. First off, he technically didn't recruit Brandon Roy.
Oh, that was Bob Bender?
Bob Bender recruited Brandon Roy.
You don't think Brandon Roy was a good shooter?
No, I mean, C.J. Wilcox, I would say, would be the best shooter.
C.J. Wilcox, Isaiah Thomas. But also, just hearing that there is a 6'8" shooting guard coming is insane to think about.
Yeah, I'm curious to see Porter play more. So I saw Fultz play a couple of games in high school last year and then in the Nike Hoop Summit. Porter, I've only watched on video during the U19 World Championships that both he and Fultz participated
in. And he was dominant in those.
Yeah, those were the two best players probably on that team. Or that wasn't actually the World Championships. I believe that was the FIBA Americas Championships that they participated in. So I'm excited to take a look at him in person.
I mean, the only player who, just from this description of him that you could possibly compare him to is Kevin Durant.
I mean, I don't know they would go that far. But he's got, there are some elements of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. But then also just looking at the whole recruiting class and knowing that there's shooting coming in, which is so huge in college basketball, and it's something that, like, been pretty desperate for years.
Yeah.
Husky basketball, knowing that there's a lot of shooting coming in between Dejon Davis and Michael Porter.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be huge. And then also a little bit of bringing in a big man who sounds like he can do quite a few different things.
Yeah, Romar talked today about his defensive versatility, ability to switch, and the defense that the Huskies like to play.
And that's in Mamoudou Diarra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one question I have, I still haven't quite figured out where they're finding scholarships for five players.
Doesn't matter.
So
they'll
I'm
figure it out.
I'm curious to see how that's going to work
out. They always figure it out.
They do. That's true.
So anyway, very excited about this recruiting class. But let's talk about the team that's going to be playing this year.
Yeah, let's not focus too much on the distant future, because in the very near future, we are going to be seeing Husky basketball playing games that count. So last Thursday, they had their exhibition over Western Washington, which they won 109-103 in a game where the teams combined to shoot.
We should talk more about the distant future.
Yeah. The teams combined to shoot, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 free throws between them.
Oh, my God.
Sounded like a real fun game. This game was not televised, was not on the radio. I was at a different game during it, so I was just following it on Twitter, as I assume most people were.
Yes.
And it kind of sounds like it was
Christian Cable was breaking down during the game. He was descending into madness.
Because so many people were tweeting him?
No, because of the fouls.
Oh, yes.
And then this Western UW exhibition game.
Yeah. It sounded like... So Markelle Fultz only played 23 minutes. His minutes have been kind of... His playing time had been kind of limited in practice leading up to this because the Huskies were trying to manage his workload after a really busy summer where he played this stretch for USA Basketball. He went with the Huskies to Australia and New Zealand. He'd been doing a lot. He'd been traveling all over the world. So they kind of tried to take it easy with him. And he was clearly the best player on the court when he was out there.
That was the other thing about following on Twitter is, aforementioned Christian Capel, every single tweet was Fultz with a steal, Fultz with the assist, Fultz scores doing this. There was almost nobody else mentioned, right? It was just a series of Fultz doing things whenever he was in the game.
Which is interesting because I think he was actually like the third or fourth leading scorer for the Huskies in this game.
It seemed like he's involved all the time.
Yeah, which is what he's going to be. And I looked this up. They were plus +7 with Fultz in the game. They were outscored by 1 with him on the bench in 17 minutes. So.
Oh, that's not actually that bad.
I was expecting it to be a little bit more dramatic.
Me too.
But the other thing is, like, it's an exhibition game. Like, other guys did play a lot, but you're not trying to win. You're trying out some things. Like, it's not a thing to get too worried about.
Okay.
Now, if the Huskies struggle Sunday, then it's a little bit more of a reason for concern because the Huskies are playing a team that made the NCAA tournament last year in their opener, that being the Yale Bulldogs, who won the Ivy League for the first time since 1962. Oh,
the fearsome Yale Bulldogs.
And then beat Baylor, took out a Baylor team with an NBA lottery pick and plenty of other talent, an NFL draft pick, I believe.
Wait, who?
Rico Gathers, who got drafted as a tight end.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They beat them and then lost a close game to Duke in the round of 32.
I remember that. I was watching that.
But it's not quite the same team. Because they lost 4 of their top 6 players from that team. And then the main guy they brought back was their point guard, Mekhi Mason, who I believe had 32 points in one of those NCAA tournament games, was really the dominant star of the team, put his name in the draft waters, reconsidered rather quickly and came back for what would be his junior year. But then on Saturday, in a scrimmage that they were playing, he suffered a broken foot and is now out for the season.
Great.
So they only return one starter now in one of their top 6 players from last year's team.
This is not the fearsome Yale team you remember.
It is not. And I think, I'm not sure what the scheduling thought was here, but this could have been one of those cases where, you know, it's a team that's going to look pretty good in terms of the RPI, and now it's not going to look nearly as good. But on the plus side, there is a significant chance of Mekhi Mason doing what Nate Walters has done in the past.
Yes.
What Kay Felder did last year, and being like the NBA prospect who comes in, point guard who comes into on a mid-major team who comes into Heck Ed and beats the Huskies.
Yep.
And no, that's not going to happen.
Yes. No, we're very, very happy about this. I mean, the chances of the Huskies effing up this game were very high before this injury. Still feel like they're pretty high to me.
I don't think they're that high now.
But if he was playing, I mean, you know that he would just hit every shot that he took. We've seen it over and over and over again in these games.
Yep. KenPom gives the Huskies a 72% chance of victory in this game. Do you have a chance of winning?
Chance of victory? I've done a lot of scouting of this Yale team. I'm going to say that there's probably about a 75% chance of victory.
I'm going to go like 85, maybe 90.
Wow.
Mekhi Mason is there, like, it's a huge loss, and I think that they were probably a little bit overrated coming in by KenPom.
The Huskies have screwed this game up so many times.
Usually they don't do it until it's December, though.
Okay. I mean, you know that they're going to have at least one terrible non-conference loss.
Yeah, I should look at the schedule and try to predict that.
And predict the terrible. That'll be really fun. Do they play UC Santa Barbara? You know they're going to lose to them.
Let's see.
God help us if they play Long Beach State.
They do play Long Beach State.
Oh no.
It's funny because it's real.
Do you have an instant prediction here? Are you looking at the schedule? If you accurately predict this, I'll be both impressed. If you could put on your Kevin Domas hat and predict what the horrifying Husky preseason loss will be.
I'm gonna go with Western Michigan just because of the timing of the schedule. I have no idea how good Western Michigan is, but they play them on the Sunday right after the end of like finals week, and I feel like that's the game they historically always lose.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different time periods. They lose a lot of games.
Which is weird because at one point they had like a 5-year streak of not losing a non-conference game at home.
Man.
Those were fun times.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. Any thoughts on the team in general? Looking, I mean, we talked a little bit about last week, but
you know, we'll see. I mean, I still think it's probably as far as Fultz leads them. David Crisp had a pretty good exhibition game, and that was encouraging to see, since, you know, we've talked about someone needing to step up in the backcourt next to Fultz, whether it's him or Dominic Green. So, you know,
I'm much more hopeful about this team in general than I think most people are. Where were they picked in the Pac-12?
I'm not sure, actually. I think like 8th.
This feels like a fringe tournament team. I think that they're going to be on the bubble for most of the season. And I mean, they were a surprising team last year who could have made the NCAA tournament. And I think they're a hair better than that.
We'll see.
You don't feel the same way?
I feel like they're about as good as last year. Yeah.
And last year, it could have gone either way. There were a couple of games that really decided their fate. In particular, those non-conference losses.
Also that Oregon State game.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Just
some great memories.
I'd forgot about that game. They came down and hit the three where the dude, I think he stepped out of bounds.
I forget what it was. He traveled. I think it's what it was.
Yeah. Something horrifying happened.
Yeah. We got screwed. I know that much.
I just can't wait for that to happen again this year. It's what's going to get us through February.
It is. In other Husky basketball news, the women's basketball team kicking off their season Friday, hosting Eastern Washington, ranked number 15 in the country by USA Today and predicted 3rd in the Pac-12 coming off their Final Four appearance last year.
Cool.
Yeah.
So speaking of Husky sports.
Yes.
This last week, I want to hear all about this. I want everything, because I haven't heard anything about this trip. Or maybe I didn't, I don't remember. But you spent the last week in the Bay Area.
In the East Bay.
East Bay? East Bay Funk Dunk?
Yeah.
Yay area?
I mean, I didn't myself personally funk dunk at any point, but yes. In the home of the East Bay Funk Dunk.
So you spent the last weekend in the East Bay going to nonstop sporting events.
Pretty much. So I flew down there last Thursday. That night, after hitting up In-N-Out, went to Thunder Warriors.
That really, for a second, sounded like it was a restaurant. It's like a medieval-themed restaurant. Thunder Warriors.
Thunder Warriors has everything. Russell Westbrook dressed wearing a photographer jacket.
Did you see that coming in?
I did not personally see
it. What was the vibe of the game? I'm curious to hear about this.
People were pretty fired up. I mean, it felt like a playoff game. Like, the amount of media that was there, the excitement of the fans, everything like that was very much a playoff
game. It was kind of like a playoff game from last year, except you took the best player from the other team.
Yes.
The fans were very fired up about stealing the best player from the other team.
Yeah. So it kind of descended pretty quickly into being a blowout and not very competitive. But it was still fun because Durant was going nuts and the crowd was loving it. And it was kind of the first, you know, they had done it against the Blazers the previous two nights earlier. But that was the first chance for the home fans to really see what this Warriors team could do.
It was a fun night.
Yeah.
I thought the energy was really good. It's like, all right, basketball is back. I think that was the first game where that was the vibe.
And the ratings were pretty incredible for that one. So, yeah, there was a lot of interest.
Are they playing on Christmas Day?
No, I don't think so. I forget. I think the Warriors are playing at Cleveland on Christmas Day.
Oh. Ooh.
I think.
Do we know when? We don't know when Kevin Durant is going back to Oklahoma.
It's not until February.
Oh, wow. That's way too long.
Yeah. I think the NBA wanted it that way to some extent. But it was interesting to have this game be so much earlier in the season. And it was kind of a much safer environment for Durant. Like, you know, obviously.
What do you mean? What do you think is going to happen in Oklahoma City?
I mean, not like from that standpoint, but from like a, he's got everyone supporting him. It's everyone except the Thunder is on his side.
Yes.
So he was getting into it with Russ. He was getting into it with Enes Kanter, but he had all this support behind him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It was a great night if you're a fan of not the Thunder. it was really, because they'd started out the season pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, until they were 6-1 before losing tonight to Toronto.
But that game was a reminder that no matter how good they play, they just can't compete with a team like Golden State.
No, and I mean, their schedule has been pretty easy and they're really going, other than that game. which also was on the second of a back-to-back after they'd beaten the Clippers.
It was a trap game for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, so it was a game that, like, always they were going to have a difficult time winning. And then, lo and behold, the Warriors had their own one of those the next night at the Lakers, where they got destroyed.
Lakers are just good.
Watched that game from a bar in Oakland with a friend of mine who's a Warriors fan.
Oh, Marshawn Lynch?
Yes.
Okay, so you went to the Marshawn Lynch store?
I did. That was how I spent my Friday, was hitting up the Beast Mode store, which apparently is one in Seattle. So I guess I didn't actually need to go as badly as I thought.
You want to go to the original one, though.
The
Seattle one might be the original one, too.
No, the Oakland one is the original, for sure.
So you spent your whole Friday doing this?
Yes. Spent 4 hours there. No.
And Nas was there later in the day. This was a big Beast Mode weekend.
It was. It very much was. Yes, Nas was playing a show in Berkeley, which sadly I did not know about until after I was, I was watching the game at the bar in Berkeley after the concert had concluded. He was playing at the...
Because he walked in.
The Greek Theater.
He was playing at Greek Berkeley?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Man, you should have gone to that. Were you thinking? You went to everything else in the Bay Area except for Nas?
I honestly would have gone if I would have known about it.
I could have gotten you in.
You probably could have. But yeah, so I picked up a Beast Mode t-shirt.
You should be wearing that right now.
That's a fair point. It's a little chilly for just a t-shirt right now in Seattle.
You got to represent the company here.
So the other thing I did Friday, I'm wearing an ESPN polo. That's why he's saying, or not polo, but hoodie. That's why he's saying that. The other thing I did on Friday was hit up a place that I have touted to you before, Burma Superstar.
Yeah, Burma.
In the Bay Area. I had previously been to the San Francisco location twice.
Wait, there's two Burma Superstars?
There's actually two in the on the east side of the Bay.
Wow.
So I went to the Oakland one, and it was just as good as I remember, and it might be my favorite restaurant in the world.
Wow! Number one restaurant in the world?
It might be.
Oh, man.
They have a chicken coconut curry soup that is as good as anything I've ever eaten.
Really?
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem you. That's the thing.
To be super into Burmese food?
Yeah. Well, if you're saying, I mean, you're a person who's trying to go through every single burrito in the burrito bracket, right?
Yeah.
which after this week, I don't trust the burrito bracket at all.
I trust it more.
And then all of a sudden, you're talking about a coconut curry soup.
Yeah. I mean, Burmese food was not necessarily something that I was like starting out thinking like, oh, this is definitely something I'm going to love. But it's they managed to, you know, they talk about borrowing from all their neighbors, their culinary traditions and cuisines. So they have kind of created the best of all these different worlds.
Wow. It's the superstar that really gets
you. So I really went there. I went there Friday for lunch with my friend who originally took me there. And then Saturday I went there for lunch with a different person.
Nice.
That's how much I love Burma Superstar.
Wow. Doubling up on the Burma Superstar.
So Saturday night, that was a prelude to going to the UW-Cal game.
Wait, before you talk, do you have any thoughts about going to Santa Clara and seeing the 49ers versus the Saints?
Yeah, that's what I did on Sunday.
Just because I feel like we're going to lead into the Huskies.
Yeah,
after that.
It was not as miserable experience as previously when I went out to, Levi's Stadium to watch the Copa America. That time I had taken like public transportation all the way out there, and it was like a 2-hour trip either way. This time we were able to, the friend I went with, his cousins live also in the East Bay. And so we were able to start from their house, which was like a 20-minute drive from the stadium. And then...
Really?
Yeah.
It's that much closer?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it's like you just go around to the east edge of the bay towards San Jose, which is near the stadium.
Huh.
So we got in pretty early. He had gotten us tickets to a pregame function that the 49ers have at the theme park that's next door.
Wait, there's a theme park next door?
There's a theme park called Grand America next door. So they have just take over the park and have like a pregame event there for fans.
Okay.
So that was...
very, very depressed 49ers fans.
They were not that depressed. Until the game started. So then we were sitting...
Wait, I want to hear more about this pregame function.
It was basically you know, the setup that the Seahawks have at the event center, except in this case,
just for VIPs like yourself.
Right. And they had,
right. Yes. That's
so
correct.
They had free food and drink.
Ugh, free food and drink.
They did.
Oh man.
No. So then our tickets were on the Saints sideline, And so we were in amongst a bunch of Saints fans, generally. Probably more Saints fans.
Do you feel like it's really complicated because we just had lost to the Saints?
Yes.
So there's a little bit of residual Saints hate.
The animosity. But then
there's kind of the permanent 49ers hate that's really not great.
Basically, I went with, I mean, Drew Brees is my fantasy quarterback, so I was comfortable rooting for him.
There you go.
Yeah, that was a tiebreaker. But it was kind of fun because it's the closest, I think, to a sideline I've ever sat in an NFL game. And so you could kind of see, like, Sean Payton going over and gesturing something to Michael Thomas between plays, which was difficult to decipher exactly what he was saying. But, like,
wow. That kind what body language doctoring? Sean Payton gestured something to Michael Thomas.
It was, like, a really weird gesture, though. It was like, obvious what he was telling him.
Wow, I feel like I was at the game.
So that was a fun experience. And then because we had nothing vested in the game and the Saints were dominating, we left early enough that we were able to avoid the traffic getting out of there.
Oh, nice. So. You should have just, like, gambled a lot of money on the game.
absolutely.
Just to make it interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been to a sporting event where I had no vested interest in either team, except for every baseball game.
I went to a game at Dodger Stadium once. I think that's the only other time I've done that.
Okay, so before then, you went to the Husky football game on Saturday night at Cal.
I did. And it turns out a lot of Husky fans went to this game.
Okay, so this is the real issue. This is the thing that we should have talked about this first. I should have not popped this bottle of champagne. I should have broken it into shards of glass and stabbed you with them. Because there's one thing that you don't have with you right now.
My pride, my self-respect, my dignity, my faith in humanity.
You don't have a Marshawn Lynch riding on a cart bobblehead with you. Unless, if you're going to break it out like Christmas Day and you save the present for the very... You save the best present for the very...
Oh, no. No, there's nothing like that. No, we just...
You're going to pull it out from under your hoodie?
We just didn't get there in time.
You didn't get there? What were you doing? There was no pregame function at a theme park next door?
There was not. We were drinking Bud Light, as a matter of fact.
You weren't at a Nas show. You weren't hanging out with Marshawn Lynch. What were you doing?
I think I was more gung-ho about the Marshawn Lynch bobblehead than the rest of the group I was with.
I need to talk to all of them personally.
That's fair.
Give me their names.
And so by the time we got over there, I think we probably just missed when they ran out of bobbleheads. So I walked around the concourse after that.
If you got there and saw that there weren't bobbleheads, you should have left and drank more.
I probably should have at that point, yes. Because then we walked around the concourse and it just taunted...
Back logic all around.
It just taunted me to, like, look at these people and see that they all had the bobbleheads.
They were probably walking around with giant smiles on their faces.
They were.
Unless they were Cal fans.
No, I was kind of surprised how many Cal fans were, like, lining up for them. I mean, obviously they love Marshawn Lynch. Like, who wouldn't love Marshawn
Lynch?
You were
surprised that Cal fans were lining up for...
Well, first off, I was surprised there were Cal fans. By all accounts, I heard there weren't.
Okay.
And then I pointed out, like, they really should have given it to the last 10,000 people in the stadium at the end of the game, because then it would have been all Husky fans.
I like that. They should have. I wonder how many people would have stayed.
I think everyone would have stayed at that point. But
what they should have done is, if it was like the last fans, that's not a bad idea.
Okay, so here's the thing. I don't think I mentioned this to you. Like, at the start of the fourth quarter, they had like a pizza giveaway for the student section, and they're like, if you stay for the fourth quarter, you get pizza.
That was the giveaway.
It's so amazing.
They don't have
to
do anything.
It's so amazing to them that people would stay until the fourth quarter.
If Cal doesn't give up 70 points, you get pizza.
Oh, it's bad. They do not have many fans. So it wasn't even close to a sellout. I don't know if you could tell this on TV.
Not really, no.
The UW section was pretty well packed. Like,
oh,
there
was good.
Three solid sections.
That was close to a sellout.
And then by the second half, their UW fans easily outnumbered Cal fans, I would say. At least by the fourth quarter.
Wow.
But the one thing we did get, no Marshawn Lynch bobblehead, but you can't replace the priceless memory of seeing Marshawn Lynch drive the cart onto the field.
That was something.
Nearly take out the band. Did you drop off his mom and pick up E-40?
He dropped off his mom and picked up E-40?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was first with E-40.
I think that's how. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. You could not actually tell from the stands.
Wow. Yay area. No, that's something. That is definitely something. I should have been at that Nas show. I'm so upset that that didn't happen.
But I did drink Pliny while I wasn't at that Nas show, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Pliny. What the hell? Pliny from the tap.
You drink where? Where were you?
At a bar in Berkeley.
And they just have Pliny?
They do. That's a thing that happens in DA area.
Oh my God.
That's why we need to move there. Also, like, we were just sitting outside drinking on November 3rd. November 4th, whatever day it was. Wow.
Well, maybe if Cal exit happens. Okay. I guess I'll accept that. Wait, this is when you were in the Nas show. You said you were drinking Bud Light when you didn't get the bobblehead.
Yes.
I'm trying to process all of this.
Other than the Pliny, I didn't drink any other good beer, really, in California. The East Bay. I went to a beer bar that was right by my hotel, but they didn't have any Pliny, and none of what they had was too exciting. Like, I had something from like Alameda Island Brewing, and it turned out to be kind of mediocre. So.
Coveted Alameda Island beer.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was that game. Is there anything else to say about the game? I mean, honestly, I felt like the Huskies could have scored at will. I was falling asleep. You stayed there and awake for the whole game?
I did.
Yeah. Do they sell beer at the...
They do not.
Anywhere? Do they have a calzone?
They do not have a calzone.
I just like that it's called a calzone.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great term.
But they don't have one at all.
The only thing that made it worthwhile to stay is like at the end of the game when their PA announcer was like saying, and the loss drops Cal to 4-5 and takes Washington to 9-0. Having that moment was like, that made it all worth it.
That staying. Was worth it staying until like 12:30.
We beat the traffic to get an Uber back to the hotel by staying around.
By sticking around for the end of the game, yeah. Beat the traffic. Well, I suppose that's something. Should we look toward next week?
We should definitely look towards next week because this is an enormous game.
If I have to rank the three remaining games in order of importance, this is number one or number two?
This is number one because it's the next game on the schedule.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Which is why next week Arizona State will be the most important game remaining on the schedule.
Yep.
So the Huskies, something we didn't discuss last week because we recorded on Monday was them being number five in the college football playoff. And a bunch of time was spent complaining about that, and it completely turned out to be meaningless because Texas A&M immediately lost to Mississippi State.
And all of that time spent complaining about that who was the dude who did that? Rod Gilmore? He wasn't complaining about it. He's probably complaining this week about the Huskies being number four. God, that was such a hard broadcast to watch. That was the best thing about being there. Marshawn Lynch riding around with E40 on the card.
Yes. So USC comes to town this Saturday, 4:30 p.m. on Fox. After game day, we'll be set up at Red Square, and we'll be there tailgating at 6 a.m.
Oh, 6 a.m. Hello. Can't wait.
In the pitch black. It's going to be awesome.
The pitch black, the rain. Yep. After daylight savings time is over.
Yep.
Wait, no, that's a good thing. That's a good thing as far as
it
early.
It is actually a good thing.
Can't wait. I mean, this is only our second time ever having game day, and the first time was kind of a pity game day.
Was it?
Yeah. It was a game day. They knew the Huskies weren't going to win the game. That was Oregon with Mariota coming in here. They had it because it was the last game at the old Husky Stadium before it was renovated.
No, that was not the last game at the old Husky Stadium. That was at the current Husky Stadium. Yes.
No.
The old Husky Stadium, we weren't there at 6 a.m. We were at our mom's birthday party.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we lost that game badly, too.
Yeah. It's all games against Oregon.
Until this year.
So here's the thing about USC. USC is still unranked in the polls, number 26 in both polls, although the college football playoff has wisely
at the beginning of this podcast, 20th. You said they were playing a ranked team.
Yeah, I'm calling them a ranked team. Because college football playoff,
in your personal rankings.
No, the college football playoff is like the dominant ranking. Now.
Okay.
But USC is, and Coach Pete has been talking about this at length, wildly underrated by people that are not paying attention to how much better they've been after they replaced Max Brown, the former Skyline quarterback who's now set to transfer, with a redshirt freshman Sam Darnold.
I think they're probably the most underrated team in all of college football.
That's quite possible.
And I've watched a lot of college football this year.
So let me
Baby Fantasy Genius forces me to watch so many random college football games.
Watched the Western Michigan game last night.
we actually did. He turned it on. I've been watching a lot of Ball State.
Really, we're trying hard to avoid the story. So Max Brown, in his three games he started, was averaging 5.5 yards per pass attempt. Sam Darnold, in the six games he started, averaging 8.7 yards per attempt. That's way better. That's second best in the Pac-12 behind only Jake Browning. He actually has the best completion percentage in the Pac-12 at 68%.
Yeah, I mean, they're scary. You look at some of the numbers that they've put up since Sam Darnold has taken over as starter. They've only lost the one game, right, against Utah. And you look at some of the point differentials. They've won a lot of these games by 20-plus points and are scoring 40-plus points per game pretty routinely right now.
Yes, and I think four of their last five games, they've gone over 40. So here's a research project I put together. If you go by the Sagarin rankings and their assessments of each team and then where the games are played, you can analyze how good the team is against certain opponents or in certain games. So in the three games Mack Brown started, the USC would have ranked 52nd in the country if you just looked at those three games.
He started four games, right?
I think it's three.
Okay.
He's only played two non-conference games because they have Notre Dame at the end of the year. In the six games that Sam Darnold has started, USC's ranking, if you look just at those six games, would be 8th in the country. Overall, they're 14th. And again, somehow, the AP in the coaches poll, in their infinite wisdom, has seen to it to not rank them in the top 25 teams.
That's crazy. People realize, though, I mean, look, game day wouldn't be coming here if people didn't realize that this was an important game.
That's true.
And I think people get it. I mean, Clay Helton was written off at the beginning of the season, right?
I think even by this very podcast, we didn't have a podcast at that point, but the two of us privately wrote him off.
Yes. He was left for dead.
Because we privately have written off Mark Helfrich. I think everyone's written off.
Let's publicly write off Mark Helfrich right now. Can we do that?
Yeah, we can do that.
Where they were left for dead at 1-3, right? But these were some tough games that they played at the beginning of the season. Stanford doesn't look like quite as tough of a game anymore.
Yeah.
And then Sam Darnold emerges, right?
A new hope emerges.
They've turned to Sam Darnold. What is happening? It's chaos at USC, right? But it turned out to be one of the most brilliant things that Clay Helton has done. But it's not just Sam Darnold that's doing things for USC.
Yeah, well, of course not, because of the fact that they're USC and they have a million amazing skill position players who are all five-star recruits.
Yes.
So that means that, for example, when they're starting running back Justin Davis goes down with a high ankle sprain and misses the last 2 weeks, they turn to their backup, Ronald Jones, who all he did the last 2 weeks was carry the ball 38 times for 394 yards and 6 total touchdowns.
Good God.
So now they have this problem, like, how do we distribute carries between Justin Davis and Ronald Jones, which I think they're going to figure out because both of them are averaging more than 6 yards per carry. It's actually somewhat similar to UW's duo of LaVon Coleman and Miles Gaskin in that regard.
It's a good problem to have.
It is. And then also their third running back had back-to-back 100-yard games before he also sprained his ankle and is questionable for this week. Then at wide receiver, maybe not the same kind of depth, but they've got Juju Smith-Schuster, who is
a first or second round draft pick.
Yeah. Maybe the scariest receiver in the Pac-12, all things considered. Mm-hmm. A little bit down from last. You're going with John Ross?
A scary receiver, but okay.
Just in terms of pure receiving talent, I think he's scarier. He's down a little from last season, but still has 48 catches for 641 yards and 8 touchdowns. Although he has been shut down at times. Last week, he only had 2 catches for 10 yards against Oregon and only 1 catch for 9 yards in the season opener, their 52-6 loss to Alabama.
That was a Max Brown game, though.
That was a Max Brown game.
He's completely thrown under the bus.
And then last week, it was a case where I think they were so successful on the ground against Oregon and just, you know, they had a lot of things get working, basically. They didn't need Juju Smith-Schuster in this game, but it's going to be really fascinating to see him match up against Sidney Jones in this one.
What about defensively? So the Huskies rank number one in the country on offense? Is this for real?
In the football power, ESPN football power index team efficiencies, yeah.
That is insane.
Yeah.
We went into the season thinking it was an excellent defense, and if we just had even good offense.
Just okay offense.
And now we're at 66 points against Cal and could have easily scored 80.
The offense is substantially better than the defense.
Outside chance they could have scored 100 last week if they wanted to.
All right, so one thing we should talk about quickly, by the way, is this week's news story in UW football, which is that Jeff Tedford, who's been serving as an offensive consultant.
I thought it was going to be a different news story.
What news story did you think it was going to be?
Joe Mathis being
Yeah, then we'll get to that one. Jeff Tedford getting hired by Fresno State, apparently on Friday, according to the Fresno Bee, to be their next head coach. This had been widely rumored.
Doesn't that just make sense?
Yeah, I mean, he's an alum. He coached there previously, I think.
It just works out for everybody. It's a nice job for Jeff Tedford.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know when he'll start. I assume he'll finish out the season with UW, at least through the regular season. But it'll be interesting to see because, you know, everyone was so down on offensive coordinator Jonathan Smith coming into this year, and probably unfairly so. Everyone always hates the offensive coordinator, as we could talk about with the Seahawks later.
Yeah.
But, you know, he does seem to probably deserve some credit for how much better the offense has been this
year. Who knows, though?
We really can't tell.
Very difficult to distribute credit there.
All right. So anyway, the USC defense, you know, I would say the most talented part of this defense is probably their secondary. They've got Adoree Jackson. They've got also Iman Marshall.
Adoree Jackson actually a good defender?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's a good defender. I mean, I don't know. It's tough for me to say. It's not like I watched it that much.
He's not the type of quarterback who we expect. Let's say that they have him follow John Ross around. He's just going to shut down John Ross.
No, I don't think so.
But he is somebody who can keep up with John Ross speed-wise.
Oh, yeah, for sure. One of the few people in the country who can do that. Both those guys have 2 interceptions and 6 passes defensed. Iman Marshall missed practice on Tuesday with a hamstring injury, so his availability for this one is a little bit uncertain. Then the two things that stand out with USC defensively, even though they're pretty good overall, again, the FPI ranks them 24th in the country, but they're not forcing many turnovers. They're 8th in the Pac-12 in how many turnovers they're forcing per game. And they're not getting very many sacks. Got 17 sacks total, and nobody on the team has more than 3.5 sacks.
Yeah, and I think that's the spot that if you're the Huskies, you look at and feel really confident about, right?
Yep.
Having Jake Browning have time, which granted, there's a pretty solid offensive line blocking for him, but if he has time, he's going to find an open receiver. And I think we can feel pretty confident that in this game, the Huskies are going to score points.
Yeah. Special teams is an interesting one. This is the first time in a while the Huskies have been the lower-rated team by special teams because they had such a tough time punting last week.
Ugh, and then also weird,
their decision to go with the short kickoffs, not maybe super great overall, I would say, in terms of field
position.
I bet
they do it again this week.
Probably so, because Adoree Jackson, as you kind of alluded to, his best skill is probably not playing cornerback. It's a returner. He's averaging 31.2 yards per kickoff return and 14.7 yards per punt return, which leads the Pac-12. They are surprisingly weak by the way. The Huskies have faced like two really good punters in a row. This week, USC's Chris Tilby averaging 38.4 yards per punt, which is 11th of the
That's where the game's going to be decided. I mean, I think looking at this game, I think a lot of points are going to be scored. Husky defense, as we mentioned, that Joe Mathis is out for the year, not creating the kind of pressure that they are. Still a good defense, right?
Well, we want the numbers on this?
I want the numbers on it.
So just looking at Pac-12 play, because you don't want to set aside the early games and the weaker schedule that they faced, they played 3 games with Joe Mathis against Pac-12 opponents. They had 13 sacks, 12.3% of dropbacks ended in sacks, which is insane. That's, again, USC has 17 sacks all season.
That's crazy.
In the last 3 games since Joe Mathis went out, they have 3 sacks, a 2.7% sack rate.
I'm hoping this is just a coincidence, and it's based upon... I actually think this is partially the case, that it's based upon the quarterbacks that they're playing. Troy Williams is an elusive quarterback. Davis Webb gets the ball out. Marcus McMarion... Marcus McMarion, just not a great day.
I think it is much more than a coincidence. I don't think it's necessarily going to continue to be this bad.
Because the pressure is not just about Joe Mathis coming around the edge. It's about Elijah Qualls coming through the middle and Vita Vea, right? It's about Greg Gaines and people like that. It's not just about Joe Mathis.
But they're definitely not as strong rushing the passer without Joe Mathis.
By the way, Vita Vea, some of those tackles. My God.
Yes.
But they're going to score points in this game, right? We can't go into this game assuming that USC, that the Husky defense is going to shut them down. Offense is going to need to score. I think this could be a game that is one of the biggest shootouts. I don't want to say in the Pac-12 all year.
Cal's playing Wazoo. Yeah.
It's going to be one of the biggest shootouts that the Huskies play all year, though.
Yes.
I think, in this and then also the Wazoo game. But I think actually matching up with USC, it's maybe a little bit more frightening of a matchup just because they can do so many things, right?
Yeah.
They're such a complete team all around.
I mean, Wazoo's been more balanced this year, but yes.
Especially on offense. They're just a good team. That's the thing, right? I mean, they probably should be a top 5 versus number 15 matchup. Something like that. Yeah. This is a more legit Pac-12 matchup than Utah was a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
So we're fortunate to have this one at home. I would say maybe even less than 50% chance of victory if we were at USC.
I would probably agree with that.
So fortunate to have this one at home, and also fortunate that the offense is coming in firing on all cylinders. And I don't think that there's any team that can stop this offense, right? Given, I mean, you look at the different things that they can do between Miles Gaskin, LaVon Coleman, all of the different receiving threats, and then you throw in the creativity that Chris Peterson and Jonathan Smith have brought to the table.
And Jeff Shedford.
I mean, this is a Chris Peterson. It's not like Jeff Tedford wasn't there when Ian Johnson was around, right?
That's fair.
Right. Well, who's the quarterback? Jared Zabransky. Jeff Tedford wasn't there. Jeff Tedford was coaching Cal at that time.
That is true.
Let's just say Jeff Tedford wasn't calling any Statue of Liberty plays against Oklahoma. But given all of these different factors, I don't think, and the offensive line, I don't think that USC is going to stop UW from scoring. But I could see the Huskies getting to 50 and USC getting to 35-40.
I don't know about 50. So what would you say chances of victory, given that this is at home, in front of what looks 70, like a sold
75%.
That is much more optimistic than me. So FPI says 78%, but I think they're underrating USC because, again, they're including those Max Brown games. And I think they're probably overrating UW a little bit because of the Joe Mathis factor. So I'm at like 65% for this game. I think this is a real-ass game.
Oh, it's a real-ass game.
So.
And it's scary. It's terrifying, right? And we're also going to have to be tailgating for like 12 hours.
We're getting there at 4:30 a.m.?
Yeah, I think so. Crunch the numbers.
Look, you know.
It's going to be so much fun, though, having game day. Just the the game is sold out also.
I don't know if it is sold out yet, but it's on track.
They're expecting a sellout. Yeah. It's crazy that it's not sold out. But this is going to be the best culture and vibe that we'll have had at a Husky game, maybe in our entire time of going to Husky games.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, Stanford was right up there, I would say. The USC game, that was Sark's first game against USC.
Was good, but it was still a Friday night.
It was a good culture.
But we're talking College game day is going to be there. People are going to be fired up for this game, right? And also, it's not a team. USC will travel some people, but it's going to be Husky fans there. Maybe there'll be new Husky fans.
I hope so.
Much like our mother.
Diehard Husky fan for the last 4 weeks. Look, she went to the Rose Bowl in, what was that, 91? 92?
I think she went to one of those. Both of them.
Yeah.
She went to two Rose Bowls and then didn't pay attention to the program for another 18 years. But I really think that this might be the best environment at a game that we've been to since we have season tickets since 2004.
And we have not had season tickets that long. I think since 2007. Maybe 2006. Well, you have had season tickets.
2006 for me, at least.
Okay.
The one of the first games I went to was against USC. Matt Castle and Reggie Bush.
That was a pretty good team.
Mike Williams.
That team could do some things.
Yeah, they had a pretty good coach on the other side.
They did. Should we talk about that coach?
Yeah. He coached both of these teams that are playing this weekend.
That's very true.
Sandwiched in with USC sandwiched in between.
Oh, I didn't think about this. It really is Pete Carroll weekend.
But I'm just so excited for football, right? I mean, I've really committed myself to sports, but what a great weekend to commit yourself to sports.
Yeah, you are sticking hard to sports. Should we talk at all about Monday Night Football? Is there anything left to say?
I think I talked about Flatstick Pub enough.
Okay.
I mean, we could.
It was a win. It was good.
It was a crazy game. We talked about earlier that Seahawks only having 3 true possessions in the second half. It was just a weird game.
Yes.
It was a game where, I mean, you look at the clock, and I look it up, and I'm like, oh, crap, this game is almost over. You didn't really realize that was the case, but Buffalo having
these long
drives.
I was trying to tell you, because before the second to last drive where Buffalo ended up punting because of a penalty, I texted you that I thought when the Huskies got the, or when the Huskies, when the Seahawks got the ball back, they were going to be in a 2-minute drill trailing, trying to win the game.
Yeah.
Because I thought Buffalo was going to go down, score a touchdown, take a 1-point lead, and then Seahawks have a chance to win the game at the end, which I think they would have done, actually. But it would have been an interesting scenario, and it was not what ended up happening.
Not even close.
No.
No. But it's a win. Just like, I mean, there's so many Seahawks Monday Night Football games in a row, right?
Yes.
Crazy, crazy outcomes, crazy plays. So many games that the Seahawks have played in a row, really. Just
yeah.
Crazy things happening all the time.
So one reason that game went so quickly and there were so few possessions for the Seahawks in the second half is because Buffalo completed 70.6% of their third downs. That was the largest amount in the NFL this season. It was the second largest amount that the Seahawks have allowed in the Russell Wilson era. And intriguingly, they've allowed opponents to convert at least 60% of their third downs now three times in the Russell Wilson era. Two of them have come in the last 2 weeks against New Orleans and Buffalo.
Good God. I mean, both pretty good third down teams.
Yes. The other thing that's at play here, by the way, you know who else is a good third down team?
Not the Patriots, right?
Oh, it's the Patriots, because it turns out since Tom Brady returned, they're converting 56% of the first downs, second over that span behind the New Orleans Saints.
I mean, it's been such a... It's hard to pinpoint what to blame this on. Exhaust has to be something, though.
I got a stat for that, too.
Oh, really?
So there have been four games in the NFL this season where the defense has been on the field for at least 40 minutes. Two of those four games have been the Seahawks at Arizona and then Monday night against Buffalo.
They were on the field for 40 minutes.
40 minutes.
Good God.
I mean, they allowed drives of 17, 16, 14 on Monday night.
It's really something where it's like, it's almost about the teams that they've been playing, though. They've had incredible bad luck in a row, right?
I know. I mean, this one I think was a little bit less. Like, obviously Tyrod Taylor's mobility was a big factor in converting a lot of these third downs.
Yes.
But it's not like Buffalo's an unstoppable offense.
Well, let's talk about the Patriots.
Okay.
Because they're good.
They are so good. They're so good offensively, I should say.
Yes.
Where they are currently number three in DVOA, but that's only because of the fact that Jacoby Brissett started two games. Like, they're already back to number one in passing DVOA. Tom Brady is number one in every single stat. He's completing 73% of his passes. Only Drew Brees is above 70% in the league. He's got 12 touchdowns and no interceptions. Like,
how many games has he been back for? Four games?
He has, yes.
And he's the unanimous MVP pick right now.
That is correct.
He's number one in everything, right? Any advanced statistical category?
Well, not the value stats, but the per play stats. He's number one in everything.
It is insane how well Tom Brady is playing. Like, this is probably, if you could take these four games, probably his best four games. That's the best that he's played since their undefeated season.
Yeah, I think Bill Barnwell looked at this earlier this week when he was making his MVP case, or maybe it was last week, and did come to that conclusion.
Great. Good news.
And what's making this interesting is they've just got so many different weapons offensively. So obviously Gronk, who's averaging 118.3 yards per game since Brady returned and he got healthy. He's catching 78% of the passes his way. Chris Hogan, newly acquired this year from Buffalo, has become a huge deep threat. He's catching 70% of the passes sent his way for 22.6 yards per catch. And then they've got five receivers with at least 250 receiving yards. Two of them tight ends, Gronk and Martellus Bennett, who's facing off with his brother in the annual Bennett Bowl.
Martellus Bennett's still questionable for the game.
It's looking pretty good.
Michael Bennett's obviously out.
Yes. And then Gronk, and then James White coming out of the backfield has been a really terrific receiver for them.
So I took a quick gander at this. You look at both Gronk and Chris Hogan, because this is a little bit different. You look at the Super Bowl, the Patriots, not necessarily that explosive of a team, right?
It was very similar to what we're talking about, where they had a lot of long, methodical drives, picked up third downs with Julian Edelman, playing through a concussion.
But so was Russell Wilson the week before. But both Chris Hogan and Gronk right now with some unprecedented stats, right? So they're both at 70% or better catch percentage.
Yep.
And 20 yards per reception. There's only one other player in the league who has 20 yards per reception. Do you know who that is?
Who has 20 yards per reception, period?
Yes. It's Sammy Coates. You would have never guessed that. You're going into your thinking phase.
You could have given me a lot of guesses, and I wasn't going to get that one.
And his, would you like to guess what his catch percentage is?
Probably like 50.
49%. Yeah. There you go. Unprecedented that they are catching the ball for this many yards.
This consistently.
This consistently, right? It's insane. I mean, it's a little bit at the expense of somebody like Julian Edelman, who's basically running like 4 yard patterns every single time.
Yeah.
So
I guess what I would say is, like, in basketball, we have this concept of usage versus efficiency. And the more usage you get, the lower your efficiency is. This is not exactly the same in football, because usage is actually probably like the percentage of targets you get.
Yes.
But in this case, you know, the longer passes.
Neither of them are getting that many targets either, though.
The longer passes you get, the lower your catch percentage is inevitably going to be, because those are harder to complete. And so they're defying that curve, basically, with where they are.
Yes. And then you look at explosive plays also. It's something that Pete Carroll talks about a lot, right?
You got to call them explosives if you really want to sound like an NFL coach.
Explosives?
Yeah. As anything, you just got to shorten it to make it a plural of the adjective.
So anyway, you take a look at explosives, right? And New England is not just throwing short passes, right? They're 6th in explosive percentage, right? That's the percentage of their plays that are explosive plays.
Interesting.
And you take the Seahawks on the other end, right? It's kind of power against power, because 4 of those games, there's 6 currently, 4 of those games, Jacoby Brissett and Jimmy Garoppolo are starting.
That's
right?
True. I mean, Garoppolo was quite good in his game and a half.
Yes. Another game and a half was Jacoby Brissett.
2.5, actually.
I don't think he had that many explosives.
He did not have that many.
Not that many explosives.
But are you saying strength against strength because of the Seahawks' ability to prevent explosives?
And then the Seahawks have allowed the second least amount of explosive plays so far this year.
Yeah, which is what's interesting about what's happened the last couple of games. Sheil Kapadia on Monday leading into the Monday night football game, the great Seahawks reporter for ESPN, had a piece kind of about Pete Carroll's defensive philosophy. And he talked about how, you know, the Seahawks are basically happy with 6 or 7 yard completions, because they're like, you're not going to be able to complete these all the way down the field against us. And lo and behold, that's actually kind of exactly what has happened the last 2 games.
Yes.
But it is out of line with the rest of the Pete Carroll era.
Yes. And we know that third downs are random.
Yeah. So the one interesting thing on the Patriots.
Yes.
If I asked you, who's got the better DVOA and yards per carry this season, LeGarrette Blount and Christian Michael, and you hadn't read on the notes here,
I think I know.
Who would you say?
Oh, I'd obviously say LeGarrette Blount.
So everyone thinks he's having like a great season because he's been great from a fantasy perspective, but he's only averaging 3.8 yards per carry compared to Michael's 4.0. And actually rates as a below average runner on
I own
per
Christian
play basis.
Michael in fantasy, and I don't feel I would rather have LeGarrette Blount.
You should rather have LeGarrette, but they're 21st overall in rushing DVOA. Like, they're not a good rushing team, and if the Seahawks can take that away and make them one dimensional, well, that's exactly what they've done in the last 2 matchups against New England. I forget where I saw this, but Brady's averaged 55 pass attempts in those 2 games.
Has
I think
he?
We're going to see something similar.
We're 1-1 in those games, right?
That is true.
Yeah. Because it was the game in Russell Wilson's rookie year, right?
It was.
Those are the last 2 times we've played New England. Yes. I mean, they want New England to run the ball.
Yes.
Right? They want to do whatever they can do to take away these big plays.
It will be interesting to see how the Seahawks match up from a personnel standpoint. I mean, obviously, you're going to get Cam Chancellor back.
It's so huge. I think they probably had this game marked on the calendars for Cam. But
I think so, too.
It is so huge getting Cam Chancellor back for this game.
But the other thing would be getting Kevin Pierre-Lewis back, so you're not having Brock Coyle in the base defense.
Yeah, that's not great.
Well, I mean, Pierre-Lewis practiced last week. It seems like there's a decent chance. I forget what his practice status was today. But it seems like there's a reasonable chance that he could come back for this game as well. Because you're not going to want to necessarily play a lot of nickel, because that forces, you know, Jeremy Lin to match up against a Gronk or a Martellus Bennett, and that's a really tough matchup.
So what do you think is the best personnel?
I think it's base, although I wonder if they'd even consider something like you put Jeremy Lane out wide, Deshaun Shedd somehow comes inside to safety, or something crazy like that, or Cam and Kelsey McCray are both on the field.
Interesting.
Like, I don't think that's actually going to happen, but I wonder if you'd consider it.
Kelsey McCray had I know that Jeremy Lane was the lowest rated nickel corner last week from Pro Football Focus.
Yeah, it was a rough week for Jeremy Lane.
Was he matched up with Rashawn Woods a lot?
He was.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact.
Yeah, that guy had a nice game.
He did.
And then what about the Seahawks on offense?
So this is where they do have a chance to do some things, I think. You want to talk about explosives. We saw explosives last week.
Finally.
Well, I mean, it was really the Seahawks. They took the training wheels off the offense. They'd been doing that because of Russell's health. What? You don't like that metaphor?
No, the training wheels off. That's what we said when Russell was a rookie, right?
Yeah, that's what they were doing lately. And not because he's injured. So they were throwing a lot of short passes, which actually is similar to New England, as quickly as Tom Brady generally gets the ball out. Like, they're not actually these big yards per play. Other than, like, Hogan's hitting some deep passes, but Gronk gets like a 15-yard seam route that he then runs 10 yards and carries four defenders with him.
Yes.
I'm not looking
forward to Cam matched up with him on
that's,
this.
That's a fascinating matchup. It's really a lot of fun. So the Seahawks up to ninth now in passing DVOA, and the Patriots defense 26th defending the pass so far this season.
Yeah, the thing about the Patriots defending the pass is I was looking at this, and they're not giving up huge gains. Again, they don't give up a lot of explosives either.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Bill Belichick's
philosophy
is very similar to Pete Carroll's in that perspective, right? Yeah. But what they will give you is you can nickel and dime the Patriots. It's something. Do you remember that Houston game where Houston didn't score?
I do remember that game.
Houston just refused to take the easy passes in that game, right? Until maybe deep into the fourth quarter when the game was over.
Look, let's not blame the entire city of Houston here. Brock Osweiler refused to take the easy.
The entire city of Houston. J.J. Watt wouldn't do it. Nobody. James Harden wouldn't even take him. But they wouldn't take the short passes.
By the way, James Harden completed a lot more passes than Brock Osweiler this season, if you look at his assist rate.
Oh, good for him. Leading the league in turnover rate? Who is leading the league in turnovers
so far? He's definitely leading the league in turnovers.
All right, there you go.
But he said he's got the all-time highest assist rate.
Really?
Yeah.
That'll probably hold up. They're willing to give up short passes. What the Patriots are built on is not letting you complete long passes, but they will give you short passes, and they'll give you a lot of them, right? And I think that's something that the Seahawks need to recognize and need to take advantage of in this game.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think, you know, their offense is now designed to do that. And especially if you get Jimmy Graham matched up, I think that's going to be a really interesting case for them, especially because I think, you know, ordinarily the guy you would have said was going to match up with him was Jamie Collins, who they traded to Cleveland.
Yeah.
During their bye.
It'll be interesting to see how their defense looks after the bye. I mean, you look at it coming in and it feels like it's a game that the Seahawks can't win, right?
Pierre Lewis played 15 snaps on Monday, by the way.
So you have New England coming off of a bye week, the Seahawks coming off of their defense being on the field for 40 minutes, right?
In a short week. And traveling across the country.
Being on the field for 40 minutes, 3 weeks in a row, basically.
I mean, they actually weren't on the field that long in New Orleans, but it was long enough.
But this could be the game where they're the team who's on the field. It could be the game that the Seahawks control the clock and have long drives. It's something that they haven't done a ton of this year.
No.
Haven't done almost any of this year. It's been a really boom or bust for the Seahawks,
right? I mean,
right?
In New England is maybe the exception to this because of how accurate Tom Brady is, but it's hard to do that without running the football.
Yes. But they'll give up yards on the ground.
But should we talk? Actually, they're number five in rushing defense DVOA. But should we talk about how bad the running game was on Monday?
Oh, my God.
Do we just not want to talk about it? Do we want to pretend it didn't happen?
The Lockett carry.
Do we want to stick to anything but running back, Seahawks running backs?
I think.
Okay, here's a question. Do you think CJ Procise again plays more snaps than Kristen Michael?
Probably.
I think so, too.
But the Seahawks can complete short passes, right? You don't need to gain. This might not be the game that they're throwing a lot of jump balls to Jermaine Kearse or whatever.
Yes.
Right? You looked at this directionally.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they're fourth defending the left side of the field and 28th defending the right side of the field, according to Football Outsiders DVOA. And that's weird because they're one of the team, the more than any other team in the NFL, they will have their cornerbacks follow specific receivers as opposed to orienting left or right side of the field.
It's pretty random.
The other interesting thing is their weakest position is defending tight ends, 24th.
Gotta feel good about that.
Yeah.
But the Patriots have given up yards, right?
The last thing I think worth noting here, by the way, is they have the lowest adjusted sack rate in the NFL after trading Chandler Jones to Arizona during the offseason. And Jabal Sherrod with 3.5 is their only player with more than 2 sacks.
Yes.
So Russell Wilson is going to have some time to throw more than any time in recent memory, especially if he's also able to be elusive in the pocket like he was last weekend. Monday.
Yeah, that'd be very nice. Yeah. So pressure shouldn't be as much of an issue as it has been.
Yes.
Right? I think that short passes will be huge. And you look at New England, of their 8 games this year, they've only held teams under 300 yards twice in those 8 games. So they're giving up yardage. And one of those games is the Browns, so that doesn't count. So they've only held teams under 300 yards once.
Only hard NFL teams.
One of the main things to look at, though, will be short passes, right? Quick passing. Being able to gain 5 to 10 yards. It'll be huge in this game. Keeping the offense on the field, right? I think mixing the run, they're going to try to do a little bit more than they did last week. I'd be surprised if they if they ran the ball as little as they did last week. And I think they'll run the ball with a little bit more success.
And I think they'll just have more plays, period. So that'll probably mean more yards.
But it does feel like there's an opportunity. A lot of points are going to be scored in this game.
Much like the USC game.
The Seahawks defense is good. They're exhausted. And honestly, nothing is going to stop the Patriots. If they held the Patriots under 28 points, I would be shocked. Unless it's a game where there's so few possessions that it warrants that.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
There's going to be a lot of points scored.
And hey, the Seahawks finally won a game where they allowed more than 24 points.
Oh, look at that.
It was only the second time, I think, in the last 5 years.
Really?
Something like that.
That can't be right.
Buffalo hadn't won any of them. So one of those 2 teams had to win.
But I think that there are going to be a lot of points in this one. I'd bet the over, I guess is what I'm saying.
All right, chances of victory?
I don't think it's as low as people think.
Do you want to know how low I think?
I think there is a 40% chance of victory.
All right, that's good. That's convenient. Because I think there's a 35% chance of victory. So the Seahawks, 7.5-point underdogs in this game.
That feels way too high. First off, we just don't lose by 7 points.
Yeah, I would probably.
When was the last time they lost by 7? Have they lost by 7 in the Pete Carroll era?
It's happened in the Pete Carroll era. I don't think it's happened in the Russell Wilson era.
Okay. So, I mean, that feels like a very high spread.
Yeah, I mean, I think more like 4.5.
Yes.
5.5. Somewhere in that range is probably reasonable. You know, Seahawks, like, with the ball late down by that amount of points, trying to drive for a touchdown.
Yep.
Or something. Or pretty much scoring a touchdown.
Either it'll happen that the Seahawks need a touchdown late or the Patriots need a touchdown late.
I mean, that's...
Those are pretty much the only 2 outcomes.
Yep.
So.
And we can guarantee that.
But this one doesn't feel like... It just really feels like there is a path to victory here. Right? And I think that a lot of people are writing off the Seahawks, and I think the offense starting to click. Russell Wilson looks near 100%, right? He looks closer to being Russell Wilson again.
I have a hard time seeing them winning the game, but I think there is a path to being competitive.
Hard time seeing them winning the game?
Yeah, I mean, New England is really good. And short week at New England after, well, they've had a bye. Like, everything is set up perfectly.
Cam Chancellor back?
Sure. I mean, again, competitive, not winning the game.
Okay. I mean, I think it'll be a 50-50 game, though.
Either way, it's an amazing weekend of football, and I also look forward to it distracting us.
You look at it playoff odds-wise, the Seahawks can lose this game.
That is true.
They can lose this game. It's not that big of a deal.
No.
Yeah.
All right. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.